The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although losing ground to Ben Carson in Iowa, Donald Trump is still leading the GOP field nationally.
We are led by very, very stupid people. Very, very stupid people. We cannot let it continue.
To some, Trump's simplistic rhetoric and bombastic swipes at rivals reveal that he's too crude to hold high office, but it's working on a broad level. According to a recent review by the Boston Globe, that may be because Trump's speeches operate at the fourth grade level. The Globe put 19 candidates' speeches through a readability algorithm used to assess grade levels in schools. Matt Visor is national political reporter for the Globe, and he wrote about the results. Hi, Matt, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what did you use to test the candidate speeches?
So there is a scoring system that is used by different publishers when they're putting out books for kids or to review scientific papers to see how general they are in readability. So we put the candidate's announcement speeches, which gave us a little bit of a apples-to-apples comparison, through the same scoring system, which looks at number of syllables per word, number of words per sentence, and things like that would kind of give you a sense on the complexity of language and how easy to understand different people are when they're speaking or when they're writing.
So Trump came in dead last at the fourth grade level. How did the others in the Republican field stack up?
Yeah, Trump was at the fourth grade. Ben Carson, who's also doing quite well in the polls, was almost next at about a sixth grade level. Some of the more complicated candidates, Bernie Sanders is at a 10th grade level. Mike Huckabee is around the same level, as is Carly Fiorina. And sort of in the middle of the pack, you know, around an 8th grade level or so, is Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, and along with Hillary Clinton, is about the 8th grade levels.
How about some examples of what makes Trump speeches 4th grade level?
Well, the sentences are very, very short, and, you know, how stupid are our leaders, you know, he'll say, or how stupid are they? You know, he'll repeat things over and over again. He says, I'm really rich. Politicians are all talk, no action. His sentences are only a few words, and those words are only a few syllables. So that's what kind of puts him at a low level, at least on this scoring system. He tends to, you know, this analysis didn't necessarily capture that, but he tends to often use the same vocabulary words a lot, you know, huge or terrible or beautiful. And, you know, it's not a huge range in terms of vocabulary that he's using.
We are going to start winning big league on trade, militarily. We're going to build up our military. We're going to have such a strong military that nobody is going to mess with us. We're not going to have to use it.
So, to be clear, this ranking has nothing to do with intelligence or education. It's just speech, right?
That's right. And so it is, in essence, looking at what level the candidates are trying to speak in order for people to comprehend what they are saying. It doesn't gauge what level they have capacity to speak or understand. Ben Carson is one of the lowest on this scoring system. But he has a medical degree and has a renowned history as a brain surgeon. You know, by all means, is an intelligent person. Donald Trump went to Wharton, you know, as he reminds us frequently. You know, he went to Wharton and has a graduate degree from one of the most prestigious business schools in the country. So I think that there is an element in here that does not capture necessarily the intelligence of the person. And in fact, you may argue that they're being more intelligent by trying to cater their speech to capture the broadest slice of the electorate as they can.
Well, so the suggestion is that the plain speak works. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Trump, his language is very simple. It's very easy to understand. There's no sort of nuance to it. I talked with one of President Obama's former speechwriters who made the point that he always took pride when Obama's speeches were at a lower grade level because it meant that they were easily understood. And he noted that one of the most inspirational political phrases in the past decade or so was Obama's campaign slogan of "Yes, we can." You know, it's three words, one syllable each. It's very simple. And in fact, you know, there's been various studies that have looked at State of the Union addresses or speeches by members of Congress. And those have shown also that language has gotten much simpler, you know, or dumbed down, you know, depending on how you looked at it. John F. Kennedy in his 1961 State of the Union was speaking at almost a 14th grade level, you know, sort of collegiate level speeches. Obama's have consistently been at an 8th grade level in terms of his State of the Union addresses. So there does seem to be more of a conscious effort in the part of speechwriters and candidates themselves to sort of dumb their speech down a little bit.
What does being a great speechmaker have to do with great leadership? Do you think there is any kind of correlation?
Well, to the degree that you're trying to move public opinion, whether it's public opinion toward your candidacy or it's public opinion toward your policy as a president, there is an advantage, I think, to being able to lead through speeches and being able to lead people through your rhetoric. And so I think that there is an upside to having good speech writers and having a good team. And that's actually another aspect is that has made language probably simpler is the increase in terms of speech writers. I mean, you have professionals on your staff whose sole job it is to figure out how you can translate your thoughts into ideas that can be understood by a mass market. That didn't used to exist, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So JFK was doing a lot of his speeches, and presidents before him were doing a lot of their speeches. And as a result, they were more complicated. They were sort of the thoughts of very educated men putting their thoughts on paper and reading them aloud.
So what gets lost when you're trying to communicate, you know, concepts that do actually operate on the collegiate or above level at language that everybody can understand?
I mean, I think sometimes what gets lost is the nuances of policy. You hope that leaders don't get to a stage that they think that the American public is unable to understand complex policies or things that have broad impacts.
Well, Matt Visor, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Matt Visor is national political reporter for the Boston Globe, and you can see an easy-to-comprehend graphic of which grade level the candidates end up in according to the Globe's review of their speeches, along with Matt's analysis and article. It's called "For Presidential Hopefuls, Simpler Language Resonates." Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we wanted to give you a sense of how presidential speeches have changed through the decades. So we collected some excerpts from State of the Union speeches, starting with John Kennedy in 1963, Richard Nixon in 1970, Bill Clinton in 1998, and George W. Bush in 2005. Take a listen and see if you think presidential language has grown simpler or more accessible over time.
The quality of American life must keep pace with the quantity of American goods. This country cannot afford to be rich and desperately poor.
The State of the Union address is traditionally an occasion for a lengthy and detailed account by the president of what he has accomplished in the past, what he wants the Congress to do in the future, and in an election year, to lay the basis for the political issues which might be decisive in the fall. Occasionally, there comes a time when profound and far-reaching events command a break with tradition. This is such a time.
With barely 700 days left in the 20th century, this is not a time to rest. It is a time to build the America within reach. An America where everybody has a chance to get ahead with hard work, where every citizen can live in a safe community, where families are strong, schools are good, and all our young people can go on to college.
Our generation has been blessed by the expansion of opportunity, by advances in medicine, by security purchased by our parents' sacrifice. Now, as we see a little gray in the mirror, or a lot of gray, and we watch our children moving into adulthood, we ask the question, what will be the state of their union?
Excerpts from State of the Union speeches there from JFK, Nixon, Clinton, and George W. Bush. And now we move even further back into political history. At the 1896 Democratic Convention, Williams Jennings Bryan gave a speech that electrified his party and won him the nomination. His so-called Cross of Gold speech is known today as one of the most important oratorical performances in American history. This story is part of the series Contenders, portraits of some of America's most original presidential candidates, and it's produced by Radio Diaries.
My name is Michael Kazin. I wrote a biography of William Jennings Bryan entitled A Godly Hero.
My name is Richard Bensel. I wrote the book Passion and Preferences, William Jennings Bryan and the 1896 Democratic National Convention.
What we want is honest money, good as gold and pure as honey, every dollar sound and true.
In 1896, the major question was a choice between silver and gold as backing for the American dollar.
At the time, Americans could actually take a paper dollar to the Treasury and redeem it for its value in gold.
But the supply of gold was decreasing, which meant that it was deflationary. And that was good for creditors, it was good for the wealthy, it was good for the banks, but it was very bad for farmers and miners and the small people of the United States. And that's where William Jennings Bryan came in. The Democratic National Convention was in early July in 1896.
Bryan was known as the most eloquent speaker for the silver cause. And so his role was going to be giving the most important speech for the silver plank at the convention.
He was very young. He was 36 years old. He'd served a couple terms in Congress, been defeated. He was an unsuccessful candidate for the Senate from Nebraska. And that was it.
Bryan was not expected to be a leading candidate for president in 1896.
He was not even a long shot at the beginning of the convention, but Bryan's Cross of Gold speech changed people's minds. We will never know how Bryan's speech sounded to the spectators in Chicago in July 1896. We can only take what he recorded after the fact and try to imagine just how it would have sounded before 20,000 people.
Mr. Chairman, and gentlemen of the convention.
There were no microphones, so you stood on a platform before 4.5 acres of people. If they were not quiet, they could not hear you.
I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity.
This is a revival. This is a revival of plain folks' democracy, to say we really are the ones who deserve to win, not those who are winning.
The man who is employed for wages is as much a businessman as his employer. The attorney in a country town is as much a businessman as the corporation counsel in a great metropolis.
Bryan had a talent to read the reactions of thousands and thousands of people and almost imperceptibly to cue them.
We petition no more. We defy them.
Now, when he gave that line, "We defy them," he moved almost imperceptibly back a step, and the spectators exploded. They threw things in the air, they stomped their feet, doing anything else that would make noise. And then when he moves forward, they'd stop, and then he'd deliver the next phrases.
We will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns."
And here he extends his arms out on either side and just stands there with his arms outstretched.
"You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold."
First, there's silence. But then there's a little bit of clapping in various parts of the convention hall. And that clapping turns into people standing on their chairs and throwing things and yelling, and then the stomping, and then it's just pandemonium.
Atlanta Constitution, July 10th, 1896. Nearly all the silver states and some of the gold states joined in the procession and marched in triumph around the floor. Hundreds of umbrellas were opened by the apparently crazed people. Everybody stood up, shouted, waved handkerchiefs, hats, flags, canes, and anything else conspicuous and portable.
He had stated so well a case for silver, a case for the little guy, that had not been made better, really, by anybody.
On the next day, Bryan won the nomination for the presidency.
The Republican nominee in 1896 was William McKinley, former governor of Ohio and former congressman from Ohio. William McKinley ran what was called a front porch campaign. He stayed on his front porch in Canton, Ohio, and had voters come to him. They'd come and be given food and drink, and McKinley would give them a little speech from his front porch, and they would go home, and then the next group would come in. But Bryan was different. Bryan traveled 18,000 miles by train, gave as many as 600 speeches in 3 months. He basically was campaigning 12 hours a day. And I think in many ways he was a forerunner of every campaign in the 20th century.
When he gets to Washington,
the election was fairly close, but William McKinley, much better financed, won by a little less than 5% of the popular vote.
Shout McKinley as we go.
And William McKinley was inaugurated on March 4th, 1897.
Be slow on our country to bestow all the aid to gain protection that we know.
Bryan's Cross of Gold speech is known historically now as one of the most effective speeches in all of American politics, but it was almost a curse, I think, in the end. I think it dominated his life. I mean, it basically became the central and defining feature of his whole career. If you can imagine a politician who can do something this well, has this incredibly splendid moment, has it at the age of 36, and then basically spends the rest of his life trying to do it again, and it never happens.
He was a natural born orator. His voice was rich and grand.
Bryan was nominated two other times for president by the Democrats, 1900 and 1908. Losing both times.
3 times he ran for president.
But at the same time, Bryan's platform of really believing that you need to make the masses more prosperous and that prosperity will work its way up to the rich rather than trickle down. His support for more government intervention in the economy to help the have-nots, that really became the core of modern liberalism. I mean, he changed his party. You can say in many ways that Bryan was one of the most important losers in American political history.
And that story was produced by the great Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. It's part of the series Contenders, Portraits of America's Most Original Presidential Candidates.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Presidential debate season is just hitting its stride with a handful behind us and plenty more to come. Voters are looking for clarity and specifics on where the respective candidates stand on the issues. Well, not everyone is so eager to hear the details, especially if they have some serious skin in the game. Darren Samuelson is senior policy reporter at Politico. He recently wrote about how policy experts and lobbyists and lawmakers watch the presidential debates differently than the rest of us. He joins us now to explain. Hello, Darren.
Good afternoon.
Well, in your article, you write that a lot of policy experts, affectionately termed wonks there in D.C., hope that candidates steer clear of certain topics. Why?
It's fascinating. If you think about it, these debates are seen on different levels by different people. The typical voter might be looking for personality, might be looking to decide if this is someone that they would trust to have the keys for nuclear weapons or America's troops. But in Washington and really around the country, you have lobbyists, you have experts on everything from transportation to energy to tax policy who are listening very closely for details that might be spoken about, where a signal might be given of where they might be going. And in this case, where you have a free-for-all Republican presidential campaign and the same thing on the Democratic side to some extent, the candidates are tempted to maybe step a little bit further than anyone would like them to go and make promises they can't keep or influence an active legislative or international negotiation that's already happening right now that can really kind of tip the scales in some directions. And they'd rather just hear nothing on their topic than hear something.
So they watch the debates holding their breath, hoping that these ideas won't get floated because then they'll get picked up on?
Exactly. Yeah, they don't want the candidates to go into extremes to even bring up a topic that maybe wouldn't otherwise come up. But, you know, in these debates, the candidates often will speak in secret codes in some respect. You know, they'll be talking about something that maybe only a couple people really know what it is that they're talking about. But it can have significant effects. I'll give you just one great example. It was sort of at the end of, I think it was the second debate, where Ben Carson made a comment about telephones and the government. A lot of people took that to mean he was talking about what are called the Obama phone, which is a something that has been around in government for a long, long time. These are phones that help people connect the medical care, and it's become a political hot button topic, though. And anything kind of with that Obama label on it can become instant political pinata. Another great example would be high speed rail, which was a big issue there at the beginning of the Obama administration. And just people do not want to hear talk about high-speed rail, which is still moving forward in California and Texas primarily. They just don't want to have the politicians bringing that down.
It's so counterintuitive. I would imagine that, you know, policy wonks thinking, oh, I hope they talk about high-speed rail because then it actually might go somewhere.
Yeah, you do hear that with the climate change advocates too. A lot of them are advocating and talking about how they want the Republican presidential candidates to be asked where do they stand on global warming and emissions policy. But then you have some other Republican policy wonks, especially out there, who do want to see some proactive action from this next administration, if it is a GOP administration, and if everyone on the stage is being urged like to follow Donald Trump and take the position of climate change isn't real, you can box yourself in. You can put yourself in a position where you are not in a position to govern going forward if you do become the president of the United States, and you do have to make some pretty important decisions on EPA emission regulations, on fuel economy standards, negotiating with Congress. And if you've said on the stage that you don't believe global warming is real because Donald Trump started that ball rolling, that could put you in a climate advocate in a tough spot.
So even if their issues are not ready for prime time, you're pretty sure all of these wonks are watching, right?
They're all watching the debate, no doubt about it. They want to see what the candidates are talking about. And obviously, it puts them into interesting places the day after the debate. I mean, if your issue does get mentioned, you do need to snap into instant lobbying mode to make sure the lawmakers and the interest groups up in Washington, either they heard what the candidate said and they might want to quickly kind of fill in the between the lines, because not a lot of detail does get mentioned in these debates. But it does put a lot of PR people, a lot of lobbyists, a lot of nonprofits on edge if their issue does come up in terms of trying to engage with everyday Washington.
How does that language or spectrum of issues in the primaries differ from that of the general elections? You know, does that feed into the concern for policy experts?
It does indeed, yeah. In a primary where there's 15 candidates debating on the Republican stage especially, the lurch is to the right. The lurch is trying to get as many conservatives excited about your campaign, which does put you in a difficult position if you do ultimately become the nominee and are running in a general election where you're trying to talk to a much wider audience of moderate Democrats, independents, people who do not vote in Republican primaries or caucuses. And so it's a big challenge on the policy front. It happens the same in the Democratic side, where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are bashing the banks and really trying to speak to the engaged voters who do show up and do take the time to vote in the primaries and the caucuses. They say things that could get them in trouble when they do try and appeal to that middle of the road segment of the country that isn't paying attention right now, but will be once we get to October of 2016 and they're starting to tune in for the very first time in those presidential debates.
Well, in addition to people who are working on transportation, there were also those you spoke to who were in tax reform, concerned about multinational corporations being talked about in terms of tax reform. And also criminal justice reform advocates told you it all pretty much depends on who talks first. Why would that matter?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's an example where we're talking about military sexual assault, an issue that has kind of taken on an unusual split up on Capitol Hill. That's been a lively debate. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York has been leading that campaign. And so basically what you have here among the Republican candidates is a couple, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who have taken the position that they really want to see some shaking up of the military justice system, and contrary to where the Pentagon is. But you have Marco Rubio, who has been engaged in this debate, who has taken the side of the Pentagon, saying, well, hold on, let's let some reforms that we've been putting in place go forward. So on that question, which really hasn't come up yet in the debates, but it is certainly primed to come up on not just maybe on military sexual assault, but and campus sexual assault. College campuses have had a wrath of these criminal incidents and rapes, and it's been a high-profile story. You have some advocates who would rather not see Marco Rubio get the question first, again, for that fear that he would take the side of the Pentagon, and then that would flush out the rest of the field to sort of take the pro-Pentagon side. I know there's a lot of chess pieces moving around here, but if Rubio were to speak first, that could leave Jeb Bush. It could lead Donald Trump and Ben Carson to take his side. Whereas a lot of these advocates for changes on sexual assault might prefer Ted Cruz and Rand Paul to get the question first to give their side of the story and potentially sway people to take a little bit different position. Again, it's counting votes up in the Capitol, which is happening. You know, the Congress is watching these debates on the presidential stage with an eye on where the votes are on various issues, including this one.
It's so interesting to think about the dynamics going on backstage at the debates as a lot more involved than what's going on stage. And these candidates, they just come up with these things pretty much on the fly, or are they really well prepped?
They're prepped to a degree. I think each candidate might be prepped a little bit more than others. They have different styles as well. Donald Trump seems to, as these debates have gone further, maybe a little bit more prepped than he was at the very beginning. They do have the beginnings of policy teams. Some of them, I think Jeb Bush's, with all the money that Jeb Bush has, he has a pretty sophisticated policy apparatus of people who worked for his brother's administration who have prepped him and given him tons of briefing books. So he's thought about it a lot more than I think some of the other less funded candidates who don't have the resources available to be as nuanced in the 3 to 5, the 7-point plans that they might want to be talking about. And then, of course, they've been thundering and complaining about the fact that they haven't been getting these nuanced policy questions, but instead have been asked questions like about fantasy football or what are their greatest weaknesses. So you have this interesting contrast. This happens all the time, that the presidential candidates will complain that they're not being asked the nuanced, weedy questions that maybe they're not actually equipped to answer if they do get them.
Interesting exercise in control, I guess.
Indeed it is.
Darren Samuelson, senior policy reporter at Politico, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you'll find a link to read Darren's article, Hey Candidates, Please Don't Mention Us. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Although New Hampshire's first in the nation primary is still months away, the invisible primary is in full swing, and many votes have already been cast.
I'm here today to endorse my friend Hillary Clinton for president.
That is Jean Shaheen officially endorsing Hillary Clinton, one of several Democrats supporting Hillary. Just how important are these political endorsements, and who is leading the invisible primary? Well, Aaron Bykoff is meticulously tracking the endorsements for each candidate for the 538 blog, and he's got some ideas for us. Aaron Bykoff, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's lay down the ground rules. Not all endorsements are created equally. Tell us what your point system is.
Right. So our point system is that U.S. representatives count for 1 point, U.S. senators count for 5 points, and governors count for 10 points. This is based on a point system used in a book called The Party Decides, which is kind of the basis for a lot of the theory around the importance of endorsements.
So who's in the lead for endorsements?
Well, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is the very clear leader and has been for some time. We started looking at this at a year out from Iowa. At that point, she had about as many endorsement points as Bill Clinton had on the day of Iowa in 1992. So she was the clear leader going in. She has continued to build on that lead. Every few days, it seems, there's someone new endorsing her. It's leveled off slightly just because there are fewer people left to endorse her, but she has, you know, continued to build that lead, and her next closest rival, Bernie Sanders, only has 2 endorsement points.
And how many has Hillary got at this point?
Hillary has 391.
So why would that have a clear lead, 391 yes. to 2? What about on the Republican side?
On the Republican side, things are much different. It's been a much slower buildup. When we started tracking this, Jeb Bush was in the lead. He continues to be in the lead, but it's a much closer race. He has 37 points. Next is Chris Christie with 25 points. Marco Rubio is at 13 points. There are a few other candidates in between them, but he has picked up 3 new endorsements in the past 2 weeks.
Yet those on the top of the polls, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, have yet to receive an endorsement publicly from any politician. Bernie Sanders has only 2, you mentioned. Do these endorsements actually influence voters?
Well, in the past, they have in a lot of cases. You know, voters tend to not pay attention, as close attention this early in the race, though, of course, in New Hampshire and Iowa, things are a bit different. But voters look to party officials to help them make their choice as to who to support. It's an indication of kind of broad who is broadly acceptable to the party. In the book I mentioned earlier, The Party Decides, the authors found that for each increase in the share of endorsements of 10 percentage points to a candidate, their share of delegates won in the primaries goes up about 8%. Hmm. So there is definitely a relationship. Now, it's not foolproof, like we mentioned, and there have been cases where the candidate who is supported earlier by more party officials does not end up getting the nomination.
What would be an example of that?
So in 2008, Hillary Clinton was the endorsement leader until about halfway through the primaries. And then once it became clear that Obama was on the verge of winning and had a clear path to winning the nomination, her endorsements leveled out. His increased just before he won the nomination. A lot of the people who had been sitting on the sidelines decided to endorse him. Mm-hmm. So in the end, the party leaders coalesced around him. It just took much longer.
I wonder if it's seen as much of a coup to get endorsements now, specifically when in a year in an election cycle, when being the anti-establishment candidate, you know, one that is not favored by Washington, is seen as a plus.
Right. That's a fair point. And I think on the Republican side, that is one of the reasons perhaps that things are going a little more slowly. But candidates are still very proud when they do get one of these endorsements. So in their eyes, it's important. We'll just have to see whether this cycle really is different.
How important is the timing of an endorsement? Better to get them early before the primaries?
Yeah, I think early is usually what the candidates would want and what would benefit them the most. I mean, at this point, for example, if Marco Rubio were to come out tomorrow with 10 new endorsements, that would be a pretty clear sign that at least part of the leadership of the party that whose nomination he's trying to win supports him. If they come out, you know, one at a time over the next 3 months, every few days, that's more of a trickle and less clear of a, like I said, less clear that the party is coalescing around him.
So there is clearly a benefit for the recipient of an endorsement. What's in it for the endorser?
Well, if their chosen candidate wins, they can say that they were in that person's camp early on. It may mean some preferable speaking role, or it may mean that the candidate then helps the endorser campaign later on. It could mean a few different things, but I think more than anything, it's just that endorser having a say in who ends up getting the nomination and being able to tell their constituents that they were on the side of the person who won.
Aaron Bykoff, thanks so much for giving us a peek into this invisible endorsement primary.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me.
Aaron Bykoff, he's a computational journalist for Nate Silver's 538 blog, and he's been keeping track of political endorsements of each of the presidential candidates. And of course, because it is the 538 blog, great graphs, great things to look at, and you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Millions of people have been displaced by war in Syria. An estimated 4 million have left the country in perilous treks across borders, on land, or in rickety boats. But it was the image of a drowned boy, 3-year-old Aylin Kurdi, who washed up dead on a Turkish beach that caught the world's attention. The photograph triggered outrage, sadness, millions in donations, and perhaps some guilt among those of us living comfortable lives, knowing that tens of thousands of children like him die every single day. There are people who devote their lives and considerable resources to saving the world's most vulnerable people and animals, sometimes putting themselves or their families at risk to help complete strangers. Larissa McFarker is staff writer of The New Yorker, and she profiles extreme do-gooders in a new book called Strangers Drowning, grappling with impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help. And Larissa McFarker joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When you told people that you were writing a book about do-gooders, that's the word you had to come up with, some assumed that people so committed to others are mentally ill or perverse. They're targets of derision and contempt. Why is that? Doing good is so suspect.
This really surprised me. I mean, I started out on this project just wanting to know more about people who devoted their lives to others and what those lives were like and what those people were like and how they came to that sense of duty. And the first sort of person that I interviewed was a group of people who had donated one of their kidneys to a stranger. And I was startled to discover how much hostility they had encountered in doing it. Their family would object. They would say, well, if you've got a spare kidney, how about me or the children? What happens if we get sick? Why are you giving it away to a stranger? Even the doctors were profoundly suspicious of these would-be donors and subjected them to batteries of psychological tests to make sure they weren't nuts, that they weren't doing it for some unacceptable reason. And indeed, about something like half the transplant centers in this country won't deal with altruistic donors at all, people who want to donate to a stranger, because the whole concept is too weird to them. And I ended up sketching a whole history of the origins of this skepticism. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations famously introducing the idea of the invisible hand, the idea that all of us acting selfishly can collectively bring about more good for society, perhaps, than if we tried to achieve that good. To give just one other example, there was a French anthropologist named Marcel Mauss who in 1925 wrote a book called The Gift, in which he discussed traditional societies he'd studied and pointed out that in those societies, giving was always reciprocal. A gift given without expectation of anything in return was not, as we often think of it, thought to be a higher, more selfless act. It was quite the reverse. It was thought to be aggressive because it gave the giver more power. It caused the recipient to lose face. It made him look dependent, a charity case. And in one of the languages Mauss studied, a gift given without expectation of return had a synonym, poison.
We've brought up so many interesting things there. I'd love to just kind of break some of them down. This kind of idea of the familial relation of those who are the do-gooders, which comes up in an extreme form in the case of Hector and Sue Badeau, if I'm pronouncing their name properly. French-Canadian family, settled in Vermont, and adopted, and
That's
then
right.
adopted all of these other children, you know, of various different needs, some of them really troubled, some of them physically troubled, emotionally troubled. So we get to see, like, what's on the other side of heroism, of do-gooderness. How does it affect the people who are supposedly being helped?
It can be very, very complicated, and I'm glad you brought this up because, to my mind, this is the deepest conflict that do-gooders face. You know, when we think about the barriers to helping others more than we do, we usually think of fairly petty things like, oh, we're too selfish, we're too conventional, we're too lazy, we're stuck in our ways. All of that is true, of course, but there's a much deeper difficulty faced by do-gooders, which is that if you're going to care for strangers and devote your whole life to them, it's going to conflict with your caring for your family. And most of us not only want to care for our family, we feel that that's the right thing to do. So we find it a little strange and a little worrisome when a do-gooder is willing to put his family aside in order to help somebody else. So the Badeaus are a more complicated case. It wasn't so clear, family versus strangers, because these are a couple, as you say, who adopted 20 kids. In other words, found 20 children who were still strangers to them and made them into their family. And in the early days, it was easier because the family was more manageable. It was four, it was five, it was six. But as the family grew larger and the kids grew older, before adopting new kids, Sue and Hector would hold a family meeting. And usually the kids were in favor, but as the family got bigger, they started to object. And they would say things like, "Mom and Dad, we don't get enough attention as it is. It's too big. This family is big enough. You got to stop adopting." This would affect them like it would affect any parent. And yet that was not all they thought about. For them, they thought, well, it's true. If we bring in another child, another four children who have most of them profound needs, it will take away some of our time and attention from the children we already have. On the other hand, think of those children whom we don't yet know, but we know their situation and we know that their lives are going to be so much harder if they don't have parents, so much worse if they don't have a family to call their own, that it's worth it to make the children we already have suffer from a little less attention if it totally transforms the life of somebody else.
That's what's so fascinating to me, the moral calculation that goes on for people. And this leads to the title of your book, Strangers Drowning. Now, this is from an essay from the philosopher Peter Singer. It was called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And basically, he observed that if you walked past a shallow pond in which a child was drowning, you would consider yourself barbaric if you didn't come to the child's rescue for fear of muddying your clothes, right? So there's this argument that he makes that it doesn't matter if you can't see that child drowning across the globe. They are still drowning. Wouldn't you do everything that you possibly could in your power to change this? So it opens up this whole dynamic of the spatial nature of giving help, that if we can't see, if somebody is not close to us in our own family, we won't extend the same kind of help, or there won't be the same kind of urgency. How does that play out in the lives of the people that you profiled?
It's a very good question, because I think for most of us, space and proximity are very deep moral facts. Peter Singer tries to make us feel as though space is morally irrelevant, and therefore it should not matter at all whether this drowning child is right in front of us or halfway across the world. But actually, proximity is a very deep fact to most of us, and so is vividness. If we see a child in front of us, we not only perceive that need, but we feel it. And if we see a photograph, for instance, of that poor toddler that you mentioned earlier, drowning off the coast of Greece, we are moved to help him in a way that we weren't, even though before we knew that there were people of all ages drowning off the coast of Europe because they were refugees, but we didn't feel it until we saw that photograph, many of us. That's one of the differences between the people I'm writing about, these profoundly committed do-gooders, and the rest of us. They don't need a photograph. They don't need to see someone right in front of them, because they have, I came to think of it as almost an aesthetic ability to conjure vividly in their imaginations the suffering of people whom they will never know, never meet. They feel it. So, for instance, I write about a couple who live just outside Boston, Jeff Kaufman and Julia Wise, and their form of altruism is fairly abstract. It does not involve seeing people right in front of them. It involves writing checks. When Julia was in college, she thought, I should become an aid worker in some foreign country. And then she thought, actually, here I am living in America with a first world education. Probably the best thing I can do is not go over there to some foreign country that I don't understand and try to be an aid worker myself, but stay here, earn money, and send as much of it as I possibly can. And she and her husband send away 50% of their salary, joint salaries, send as much money as I possibly can to effective charities who can then use it to bankroll three or four aid workers who would be much more effective than I would by myself. When people hear about their story, I find that sometimes people find it unmoving and even repellent, the idea of an altruism that is so divorced, as they see it, from empathy, from the feeling you get from seeing someone in need. But for Julia and Jeff, it's a kind of modesty. It's a realization that they could use their resources trying themselves to help people in their neighborhood, but they would be less effective than if they gave as much money as they possibly could to aid workers who know their own countries better than they do.
What leads people to do extreme good in the world, and why are some people so committed to helping others, even complete strangers, sometimes at the cost of their own families? Well, Larissa McFarker is with us. She's a writer for The New Yorker, and she's written a new book about extreme do-gooders called Strangers Drowning. There is a moment early in the relationship of Julia and her then-boyfriend, Jeff Kaufman, when he buys her a $4 candy apple. Right. And it provokes mm-hmm. such anguish in her. Like, I could have bought a malaria net for that $4. You know, there's a question of what is enough. And that's where I see the passion and the warmth. But there's also activists who get together and say, you know, is kind of a humble bragging about you can save more lives than Oscar Schindler doing this, or I've saved more lives than Superman. If human lives are on a spreadsheet, that feels to me cold. That feels to me calculating.
There's no question that there are some altruists who think about their altruism in a very cool, rational way, and they don't necessarily get moved to tears by the suffering of people far away. They just coldly decide, it is my duty to help them as much as I can because I have so much and they have so little. It's simply what I must do. Now, I think such people deserve enormous credit because they have done much more than most of us do. In the case of Julia and the candy apple, that, you know, it's a funny story because this was Julia at age, I believe, 21 or 22. And she was still at a very overwhelmed, passionate, emotional stage in her moral life. It's hilarious to think about. And indeed, Julia herself finds it hilarious now because she's done something that's very hard. Over the course of her 20s, she's now, I think, 30, she figured out, along with her husband, a system that would set some moral parameters because they both realized that evening, if Julia was going to burst into tears every time she made a tiny little purchase because she thought of malarial children sort of clawing at her windows and saying, how could you, she was going to lose her mind. Right. And that was not going to be to anyone's benefit. Another decision that Julia and Jeff had to confront, which was a much larger decision than a candy apple, was whether or not to have a child. Julia had always wanted to have a child since she was a child herself. She always used to imagine games she would play with her kids, toys she would make for them. And then at a certain point, it occurred to her, oh, if I have a child, that will take away an enormous amount of resources that I would otherwise have given to charity. So by having my own child, I will, in effect, be killing other people's children. Mm. And then eventually she realized, you know, if I don't have a child, that will be the point at which I feel like my life is not just constrained, but blighted. And it will destroy me.
Paul Wagner is the man that you profile who gave a kidney to a stranger that he found on, you know, a website who was needy. His original instinct was to not let that person know who he was. He wanted to do it anonymously because he suspected his own motivations of heroism, you know, his own ego appeasement. And we mentioned earlier how people sort of feel judged by do-gooders. I wonder if we knew more about what these people were doing, about their sort of normal acts of heroism and selflessness, would we be encouraged to do more ourselves?
That's a very interesting question, because we may know that giving more makes us happier, but if we also feel, perhaps even unconsciously, that giving more will make us into a different kind of person, someone more self-righteous, someone more judgmental, then our desire not to become that person may be too strong for our impulse to give. So that was part of the reason I wrote this book, was I wanted to restore a sense of the beauty and the grandeur of very moral lives, which I felt had become obscured with all kinds of cliches and notions about how do-gooders are unhealthy and twisted and generally weird. And I wanted to give a sense that these people are tough and relentless and extraordinary, and hopefully by so doing, take away some of the barriers to the rest of us wanting to do more good.
Larissa McFarker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Larissa McFarker, she's staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. There's much more on the book. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of our archives to listen to. You can post them on social media or email them to friends. And let us know what you are hearing from your circle of friends and colleagues and sources. We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.